says the terrorist attack on Iran's embassy in Syria is a sign of Israel's profound desperation and last struggle of a falling regime. And the World Bank says Israel's onslaught on Gaza has inflicted about $18.5 billion in damages to the Palestinian territory's critical infrastructure. Thank you for joining us. The United Nations Security Council has held an emergency meeting on the latest Israeli attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Syria. Addressing the event, Iran's deputy representative to the UN called on the world body to vehemently denounce Israel's violation of the international regulations.
Regrettably, the absence of accountability and the Council's inaction has only encouraged and even emboldened this regime to continue its violation unchecked. It is high time for the Security Council to shoulder its responsibility and address the real threat to international peace and security. The Security Council must promptly fulfill its duty in response to Israel's reckless defiance. Urgent and enforceable measures must be taken to compel this regime to uphold its obligations.
Zahra Eshadi said Israel is defying Security Council resolutions and shows disregard for its international obligations. Syria's ambassador to the UN also called the attack a grave violation of international laws and norms. He said the Arab country holds Israel and the US fully accountable. The Syrian official added that the Israeli regime would not have dared to attack other nations' diplomatic premises if it weren't for Washington's blind support. The Russian ambassador, whose country had called the meeting, slammed the airstrike as a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. He said Israel seeks to further fuel the regional conflicts. China's envoy also condemned Israel's attack as a grave violation of the UN Charter and international law and a breach of the sovereignty of both Syria and Iran. Earlier, we were joined by a political analyst, Sayed Mohammad Marandi from Tehran, to discuss the Israeli strike on the consular section of Iran's embassy in Syria. He says Israel continues with its atrocities in the region because of the U.S. political and military support. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli regime is allowed to carry out any atrocity because of Western support. We've seen for decades how they've imposed apartheid, how they've carried out ethnic cleansing, how they regularly carry out massacres in Gaza, in the West Bank, and now we have a genocide. So when the West allows the Israeli regime to conduct itself this way, there's really no surprise when it carries out an attack on sovereign countries. The Iranian embassy is a part of Iran's sovereignty, and the murder of Iranian officials in that building is an attack on the Iranian people and the Iranian state. What I find extraordinary, though, is that even now, Western regimes do not condemn the regime, even in a way in which makes it look as if they're serious. The U.S. is definitely complicit. It's more than complicit. The United States is the senior partner in the Holocaust in Gaza. Everything that the Israeli regime does can only be done with direct U.S. support.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has vowed Tehran will make the occupying Zionist regime regret its deadly airstrike on the Iranian embassy in the Syrian capital, Damascus. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the remark in a message of condolence on the martyrdom of a group of Iranian military advisers in Monday's Israeli aerial raid on Syria. The leader described Israel as a hated occupying regime. He vowed that the evil regime will be punished. Ayatollah Khamenei also saluted the martyrs of the attack, including two senior IRGC commanders, Major General Mohammad Reza Zahidi and General Mohammad Hadi Haj Rahimi. Iran's president says the terrorist and criminal attack on the Iranian embassy in Syria is a sign of Israel's profound desperation and helplessness. Ibrahim Raisi was speaking in a phone conversation with his Syrian counterpart, Bashar al-Assad. He added that the passivity and weak position of some Arab countries has prevented the Islamic world from adopting a united stance against Israel and made the regime more brazen in committing crimes. Raisi described Israel's insane actions as the last struggles of this falling regime, which does not respect any humanitarian and international principles. He also slammed the US and its Western allies for providing financial, weaponry and media support to Israel. Assad, for his part, condemned Israel's attack as a violation of international laws and a sign of moral degeneration of the regime. He also expressed his condolences to the government and nation of Iran and the families of those killed in the Israeli attack. The Israeli attack struck the consular section of Iran's embassy in the Syrian capital, Damascus, resulting in the martyrdom of Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and six other Iranian military advisors. Here's a profile of the general.
Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a senior commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' Quds Force, was killed in an unprecedented Israeli attack targeting the five-story consular building of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. Born in 1960 in the central Iranian city of Isfahan, Zahedi joined the IRGC in 1980 and fought in various battles during the Iran-Iraq War. Zahedi quickly rose through the ranks and from 1983 to 1986 took command of an important brigade of IRGC ground forces that was used to break enemy lines in multiple major operations. Later, he was promoted to commander of the IRGC's 14th Imam Hussein Division, a position he held until 1991, several years after the war had ended. In the 2000s, Zahedi served in more senior positions, including commanding the IRGC's Air Force and also Ground Force. During his tenure as the IRGC's Ground Force commander, he also spent a year at the helm of the Thara Law headquarters, which is responsible for protecting security in the capital, Tehran. Zahedi joined the Quds Force in 2008. There, he led operations in Syria and Lebanon, and played a key role in Iran's advisory support for Syria's war on terror. From 2016 to 2019, the Brigadier General returned to Tehran to serve as the IRGC's deputy for operations. He rejoined the IRGC's Quds Force in 2019 and served the force until his martyrdom.
Syrian Prime Minister Mohammad Hussein Arnous has denounced Israel's recent attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus.
This is an unlawful attack. We are doing everything we can to retrieve the bodies from under this building. We have been working non-stop since the moment of the attack until now. What happened is unacceptable to common sense. As you notice, as journalists, this is a crowded highway. But this enemy knows nothing except violating laws.
Arnous made the comments while visiting the site of the incident. Earlier, Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad condemned the terrorist attack in the strongest terms, adding that Israel will not be able to undermine the relations between Iran and Syria. The military wing of the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas also offered its condolences on the martyrdom of Iranian General Zahedi and his fellow advisors in Syria. In a statement, the Al-Qassam Brigades denounced, quote, the cowardly assassination of the Iranian advisors who died for the cause of Al-Quds in the treacherous Israeli bombing. Iranians in several cities across the country, including the capital Tehran, have held anti-Israeli and anti-US protests after several Iranian generals and officers were killed in an Israeli attack in Syria. The protesters demanded decisive response and revenge for the deadly strike on Iran's embassy in Damascus. Fatima Masumi has this report.
Iranians took to the streets of the capital Tehran and gathered at iconic Palestine Square at midnight after the deadly Israeli attack on Iran's embassy in Syria. They chanted death to the Israeli regime and death to America as they waved Palestine flags. The protesters expressed their support for Palestinian people in Gaza as Israel's genocidal war continues unabated.
When we heard what has happened, we couldn't tolerate it, and we came here for the sake of our martyrs. Our Muslim brothers and sisters, Palestinians, Syrians, are all a part of our own nation, and there's no difference between us.
Two of our generals were martyred, so we have gathered here to show our readiness for retaliation. We are asking the Islamic Republic of Iran to take serious action against these atrocities and the disrespect towards our nation and also the innocent Palestinians.
On Monday, Iran's ambassador to Damascus, Hossein Akbari, confirmed that Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi and his deputy Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi were killed in the Israeli attack.
It is our duty to come out because we felt that even though the resistance movement is showing patience towards the Israeli regime, we are still witnessing that the regime is pressing ahead with its atrocities, with the recent incident of the attack on the Iranian consulate.
We have gathered here at this hour to show that the innocent martyrs in Syria were killed amid injustice and impunity by the bloody hands of the Zionist regime. The regime has been killing innocent people, especially children, for many years.
The attack came as almost 6 months into the Gaza hostilities, the regime has failed to achieve its objectives of destroying Hamas, despite killing tens of thousands of Palestinians, mostly women and children. The two slain Iranian generals had been comrades of top Iranian anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani, who was also assassinated in an attack in January 3, 2020. General Soleimani played a key role in fighting and decimating the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria.
A large number of people have gathered here in Palestine Square to strongly condemn the recent Israeli attack on the Iranian consulate in the capital of Syria, Damascus. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
A joint report by the World Bank and the United Nations shows the Israeli war on Gaza has caused damages of around $18.5 billion to Gaza's critical infrastructure. The report says the structural damage caused by the Israeli carpet bombing of Gaza has affected every sector of the Palestinian territory's economy. The damages are equivalent to 97% of the combined GDP of the West Bank and Gaza in 2022. The report covers only the first 4 months of the Israeli genocide in Gaza and embodies some aspects of the besieged strip's humanitarian crisis as well. It has found out that more than half of the territory's population is on the brink of famine. The report also said over 70% of the Palestinians in Gaza have been displaced due to the ongoing Israeli airstrikes and bombing. Israel deliberately terrorizing aid workers and disrupting humanitarian activities in Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says nearly 180 of its staff have been killed in Israeli onslaught on the war-ridden territory, several in the line of duty. The UN body added that the war on Gaza has witnessed the highest number of aid worker deaths ever recorded in any conflict, emphasizing that humanitarian personnel must be protected at all times. The statement comes as an Israeli airstrike in the central city of Deir al-Balah has claimed the lives of seven international aid workers associated with a US-based charity.
The WCK team was traveling in a deconflicted zone in two armored cars branded with the WCK logo and a soft-skin vehicle. Despite coordinating movements with the IDF, the convoy was hit as it was leaving the Deir al-Balah warehouse, where the team had unloaded more than 100 tons of humanitarian food aid brought to Gaza on the maritime route.
Israeli Premier Benjamin Netanyahu has admitted the attack was carried out by the regime forces but claimed that the raid was unintentional. The head of the World Central Kitchen, however, has called the incident a targeted attack, saying the strike indeed targeted humanitarian organizations showing up in the direst of situations where food is being used as a weapon of war. Meantime, international condemnations have been pouring in following the attack, with the US, which is the regime's staunchest ally, expressing deep concern over the strike. Australia has also slammed the attack as completely unacceptable. The UK, meanwhile, has urged Israel to provide an explanation. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabeh joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to update us or give us an update on the situation in the war-ravaged strip. He says Israel has continued with the strikes against residential buildings across the besieged territory. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli forces committed at least 7 appalling massacres, claiming the lives of 71 Palestinian civilians, in addition to injuring roughly 130 others. These numbers actually took the whole number of the Palestinian civilians who have been killed since the beginning of this onslaught on Gaza Strip to roughly 32,920 Palestinian civilians. Over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes destroyed a residential building in the eastern part of Deir el-Balah city, particularly in Abu al-Ajin town, which is located in the eastern part of Deir el-Balah city. But while when it comes to Khan Yunis city, the western part of Khan Yunis city, particularly the vicinity and the surrounding areas of the Nasser Medical Complex, witnessed more destruction as more residential buildings were blown up by the Israeli occupation forces in that area. When it comes to Rafah city, the number of the Palestinian civilians who were killed over the last attack that took place and during the last night amounted to 10 Palestinian civilians, including five Palestinian children, after they were attacked while they were sleeping inside their house. The Israeli occupation forces destroyed their house over their heads.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out fresh attacks on Israeli positions in response to the regime's ongoing genocide in Gaza. The umbrella resistance group says the attacks reaffirm its determination to continue striking Israeli strongholds. Our correspondent Muslim Salem reports from Baghdad.
The Islamic resistance in Iraq has been standing in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza by carrying out retaliatory operations in the region. Resistance forces in Iraq have started their operations by striking a number of U.S. military bases in Iraq and Syria in response to Washington's support for Israel. The operations have now entered a new phase as Israeli positions have been directly targeted in various locations such as Haifa, Eilat, and elsewhere. The intensification of the attacks on Israeli positions shows that the massacres being committed by the regime in Gaza will not remain unanswered. The second phase of the operations, which directly targeted Israeli positions, proves that regional resistance groups are able to inflict serious damage to Israel's maritime and airspace interests.
Resistance groups in Iraq and across the region have proved their ability to respond to the Israeli crimes against innocent civilians. They vow that their operations will intensify even more as long as the genocidal war on Gaza continues. Muslim Salem, Baghdad.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell." We'll be right back.
the limelight.
In Britain, Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt has made no mention of the fact that the government's flagship plan to send refugees to Rwanda will cost the British taxpayer overall more than £500 million. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has suffered his heaviest defeat in the House of Lords after the Archbishop of Canterbury and former Conservative ministers joined forces with the opposition to force through 5 amendments to the Rwanda deportation bill. The string of government setbacks, most passed by unusually large margins of about 100 votes, means the legislation which aims to clear the way to send asylum seekers on a one-way flight to Kigali in Rwanda will have to go back to the House of Commons. The Prime Minister has previously warned the unelected chamber against frustrating the will of the people by hampering the passage of his Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill, which has been approved by MPs. Rishi Sunak has made stopping the boats a key pledge of his leadership. However, he has been hit by several setbacks, including the bill being challenged in the courts of law. Recently, official auditors said it will cost £1.8 million to send each of 300 migrants to Rwanda. The draft legislation and a treaty with Rwanda are intended to prevent further legal challenges to the stalled deportation scheme after the Supreme Court ruled the plan was unlawful. As well as compelling judges to regard the East African country as safe, it would give ministers the power to ignore emergency injunctions. It has been warned that the legislation is fundamentally incompatible with Britain's human rights obligations and would flout international law. But No. 10 Downing Street has said the government remains committed to sending flights to Rwanda in the spring. In all, peers backed 5 changes to the bill recently, including ensuring it complied with the rule of law and that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda to be safe until the treaty with its promised safeguards is fully implemented. The Lords also supported a move that would allow the presumption the country is a secure haven to be challenged in the courts of law. Among those to vote against the government were the Archbishop of Canterbury, Reverend Justin Welby, and Conservative grandees Kenneth Clark, Lord Devon, and Viscount Hailsham, who have all previously held cabinet positions. The size of the defeats raised the prospect of an extended tussle between the House of Commons and the House of Lords during ping-pong, in which legislation is battled between the two houses until agreement is reached. The barrister and independent crossbencher David Anderson said the provision in the bill requiring Rwanda to be treated as safe takes us for fools. Proposing an amendment that would allow the presumption to be challenged in the courts of law, Lord Anderson added, "If Rwanda is safe as the government would have us declare, it has nothing to fear from such scrutiny." The Archbishop of Canterbury, Reverend Justin Welby, said international human rights law had developed following the horrors committed by Nazi Germany to act as a fallback and stop on governments. The Archbishop said, "We are not in any situation remotely like that, let's be clear," adding, "The government is not doing something on the scale of what we saw at that stage, but the government is challenging the right of international law to constrain our actions." Lord Kenneth Clark, the former Chancellor, said he hoped there would be a legal challenge to the bill if it was passed. He said, "I cannot recall a precedent in my time where a government of any complexion have produced a bill which asserts, a matter of fact, facts to be fact. Later, responding to concerns about the mental health support asylum seekers would receive in Rwanda, the Home Office Minister, Andrew Sharp, said, "It would be far in the best interest, mental health interest of those seeking asylum and who are victims to seek asylum in the first safe country they come to." The government recently faces the threat of further defeats when the bill is again before the House of Lords. Britain and France are planning to establish a new customs partnership designed to disrupt the supply chain of small boats in the Channel. Recently, James Cleverly, the Home Secretary, hosted a meeting in Brussels, Belgium, of the Calais Group of Northern European countries. They plan to disrupt the supply chain of boats, parts, including engines and building materials. Website Reddit has also covered the same story. Not surprisingly, in his budget, Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt, made no mention of the fact that the government's flagship plan to send refugees to Rwanda will cost British taxpayers overall more than £500 million. As the National Audit Office has revealed, for each of the first 300 people that will be flown to Kigali, Rwanda, it will cost a staggering £1.8 million. It is hard to believe that it was almost 2 years ago, in a speech in the Rwandan capital, that Priti Patel, the then Home Secretary, presented the UK-Rwanda deal to the world as a so-called groundbreaking agreement. Yet the government is still trying to get more laws through Parliament to make it happen. Having already passed the Illegal Migration Act, which, as was made clear by the UNHCR, amounts to an asylum ban, the Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill is now reaching its final stages, with the House of Lords voting to radically amend it recently. Prominent peers, including those on the government benches, expressed deep dismay that the bill rides roughshod over the rule of law by overturning the Supreme Court judgment that Rwanda is not a safe country to which to send people seeking asylum. Lord Tugendhat, the Conservative peer, whose nephew, Tom Tugendhat, is a Home Office Minister, lambasted the government for behaving like the ruling party in George Orwell's 1984. The barrister and independent crossbencher, Lord Anderson, pointedly said the legislation takes us for fools. In all, peers have made 10 changes to the bill, including ensuring it complies with the rule of law and that Parliament cannot declare Rwanda to be safe until the treaty that governs removals to the East African country, which includes safeguards, is fully implemented. The laws also made important amendments to ensure far greater protections for victims of modern slavery and human trafficking, and for children whose age is disputed. The bill will return to the House of Commons in less than 2 weeks, and the government will certainly reject all the law's amendments. The word in Westminster is that the only very modest concession No. 10 Downing Street is prepared to offer is to put in place an independent monitoring mechanism. This would replace the current arrangements for a monitoring committee that has already been appointed by the UK and Rwandan governments and includes those supportive of the policy, such as Alexander Downer, a former Australian politician who has been a vocal advocate for the new legislation.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to the listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa
rahmatullah.
Very welcome to the show, Viewpoints. So regarding the speeches of the leader of Iran on the concept of human being, and the we can say the most important speeches that the rahbar gave on the role that the human being might have in today's world, there have been a series of discussions, and we try to get into the different dimensions and angles of the life of the human beings. For today's discussion, we want to talk about human rights and first of all, we have to define the rights. I mean, what are the rights for a human being? Let's start with whom? Sheikh Sadiq or Brother Ali? Sheikh Sadiq, let's start with you. What are these rights that the human is looking for?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think a more appropriate place to start is the position of human.
Okay.
In both a materialistic or, let's say, Western worldview and a Tawhidi one. In a materialistic worldview, human is the center of the world. And being the center of the world, being the highest creature, means having all the privileges. You can do whatever you want because you're human. You can slaughter animals. You can use and abuse the environment. You can do whatever you want because you're human. You're the god. But in an Islamic worldview, in a Tawhidi worldview, human is still the highest creation, is the best of a creation. But it doesn't mean just having all the privileges. It's having the highest privileges, but also the highest responsibilities.
Sheikh Sadiq, again, this is the question. Okay, respecting for the human beings in general and being after the rights of the oppressed ones, okay? So, I think in a previous program you said that 1% are ruling over the world and 99% are looked as the instruments. So, it seems the play is very much difficult, brother. So, how can this 1% look for the true rights of the human beings in the world except getting to an absolute source of power, which is the absolute power of the creator, of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? I think in this play of this world, that 1% might not be successful unless doing that. Is it so?
Yeah. The human rights that is talked about in the West is actually the bare minimum. Mm-hmm. Right? It's just there to avoid the inhumane activities that happen, like the war crimes and stuff like that, like the right to go to trial before being executed. Like that's the level of rights that we're talking about. The right to not be killed.
Yes.
These are the rights that we're talking about.
Okay.
And even this bare minimum is not practiced because of the hypocrisy that you talked about, and it's there. And they're basically giving the illusion of human rights, the illusion of having rights, the illusion of freedom and everything else to people just to keep them silent.
That's right.
And on the contrary, when you look at, for example, Risalatul Huquq by Imam Sajjad, it's not talking about the bare minimum. Mm-hmm. Like you have the right of your father, the things that if you talk about in the West, it's like you're doing your father a favor. It's not his right. But in Islam, that's his right. That's your mother's right.
Yes.
And even your body parts, like this is the right of your hand.
Oh,
this is the right of your feet.
Very good.
Even not even animals or environment or objects, even actions have rights. This is the right of your prayer. This is the right of your fast.
That's right.
This is the right of Hajj. This is the right of Zakat. Everything has rights.
Okay.
And like we're talking about a much, much higher standard when we talk about rights.
Yeah, and the look is really beautiful, you know, just dating back into more than 1,000 years ago, but it still could be available. And I think that we, I don't know, I don't want to judge again the Western system, but...
Oh, please do.
because...
Be my guest.
You know, but the case is that these rights that we are talking about nowadays, I think, is very much... simplistic and
Hippocratic.
Yeah, yeah, right? Hippocratic,
because
that's right.
They've been doing like slavery
until so many years.
Yeah, until very recently.
Yeah, 1950.
Or women's rights, whatever you look at.
Yeah.
They've been violating all these rights.
Yes.
They've been doing all these crimes.
Yes.
And now they're criticizing other parts of the world.
Still doing.
And they're trying to overcompensate for everything.
Overcompensating, that's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So we see this hypocrisy everywhere, and they don't even catch up to their claims.
That's all right. How is observing human rights possible? From one side, you're selling weapons to the Saudis to kill Yemenis, and from the other side, you are looking for a peace treaty between the two. How is it possible?
Yeah, I told you.
I mean, just look. From one side... The weapons industry, the military industry, is very much, financially speaking, boosting all around the world, okay?
Because that's the power of media, isn't it?
No, this is the real power, brother.
No, because, you have a huge list of violations.
Yes.
Like, where do I start?
Yeah, man.
Which part of it, like, just let's spin the globe and just pin somewhere and see your violations over there. Just pick somewhere randomly. And you have all these violations, and through your media, you portray yourself as a hero.
Yeah.
And then we have all these amazing realities here.
But again, out of the power of media, they hide these realities.
Exactly.
You see?
And portray the opposite.
Yeah. If you want to study, for example, about human rights in Islam, then when you check, I don't know, when you Google it, what will come up first?
Yeah.
The thing that they have fed. You see, nothing about the. That's why the leader of the Islamic Ummah, in a letter to the youth of Europe,
but that's something we lack too, right?
Yeah. Ask them to
shout out here to anyone who is working on media.
Yeah,
like we need to work on it more.
Very.
We need
true.
To. Like,
yeah, we
take
have
this
to work
very,
on it. Yes,
very
we
seriously.
Have our own planning. You know. Our own models, you know,
when
we
have
to introduce
tell them that refer to the Islamic
original
sources
original right.
of the
original,
Islam
yes.
to tell you what their human right is, then
okay.
come and condemn us.
That's
but
right.
they don't let them to know what Islam says. For example, they introduced Saudi Arabia as a role model for the human rights.
Yes.
When no human right can be actually seen and okay. interpreted there.
Yeah.
You see, this is again the power of media. To show themselves good, to hide the realities and beauties of Islam in the human rights and in the definition of human rights, this is a power of media. I call it media empire.
Mediocrity we have nowadays.
Yeah. So we see the Sheikh was actually pinpointed the right point, which is the power of media, which actually deviates everything and
yes.
does not let... or do not let the people to reach and to find the realities of
yeah.
Islam. Thank you, Sheikh. Sorry for interruption.
Yeah, when I look at the situation with their media against ours, I remember the lecture of Imam Ali in the Battle of Siffin. He says to his soldiers that soldiers of Muawiyah are amazing at their battle.
At the kuf.
Yeah, their
yes.
kuf.
Yes.
And you are so weak at your haqq.
Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm.
I want to take one of them and give 10 of you.
Oh.
Right? So this is the same with our media.
They are
presenting their battle so good, and we have all these amazing things. We have haqiqa here, and we cannot present it. We don't have the power to present it. It's a very sad reality.
That's all right. And I think the absolute haqiqa is the hands of the imam of the age, the hujjah, you know. I think if the type of the haqiqah, the truth, he's going to show it to us, might crystallize our eyes to the very reality of the world, even for ourselves.
But bro, because it was at the hand of Imam Hussein as well. But
yeah,
then,
I know.
And if again through the power of media, Imam Hussein is not looked at as the way that
he deserved
to be seen.
Yes.
So again, the Imam will be sacrificed again.
That's right.
You see, we have to prepare ourselves. I mean, we have to again through the power of media, we have to strengthen the media that we need to have. Because I believe I have seen a hadith, a narration that said the connotation of the hadith says that Imam will not emerge until your media is as strong as it is needed.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. Media means that media your word has been reached to the world to the extent it was supposed to be.
The medium, that's right.
So it is very interesting that even media is something that actually paves the way for the emergence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
That's right. Of course, this media tech does not mean the technical media now, there's radio and TV, but the medium, you mean
this
the
is an instrument
it could
for
be
reaching,
Arba'een,
yeah.
right?
Yeah,
a lot of people
anyway.
Talk about how Arba'een is introducing Imam Hussein.
Arba'een walking,
and when the Imam of our time reappears,
he
introduces himself
as
the grandson of Imam Hussein, because everyone in the world knows Imam Hussein. No one knows Imam Sadiq, for example, in America.
Yes.
But they've all heard of Imam Hussein alayhi salam through Arba'een pilgrimage.
That's all right. Okay. I hope that one day the rights of the human beings are observed in the true sense of the word, as regarding the true position of the human being and the world, the best creature of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. First, we have to understand this, give importance to the intellect of the human beings, and also the intellect that is under the shadow of divinity. You know, this is very important. Man-centrism and self-centrism must be forgotten, you know, if you want to have human rights observed in the true sense of the world. Because anything you do will be according to your own personal decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And according to the personal decisions, one day might be right, the other today might be wrong. So nowadays, see how many movements do we have in the world? Mm-hmm. Color people, you know, different languages, minorities,
nationalities, races,
you know,
geography.
I mean, look at the women and the men, you know, are looking in some of the societies after the rights. And so today in the legal system, this law is issued and that law is issued, this law is rebutted and that law is denied, okay? So how many times and how many ways, you know, up to the end of the world, you're going to do reformation on the law system and you are getting nowhere. Because the position of the human in this chart might be understood in a wrong way. So we have to get into the true definition of the human being, I think, and understand its true rights. Then I think the problems are solved. Thank you very much, Sheikh Sadiq and Brother Ali, for your presence in the program.
Pleasure.
Viewpoints.
Thanks to you, brother.
Beautiful discussion on the concept of human rights as tackled by the leader of Iran, by the leader of the Islamic Ummah, Sayyid Ali Khamenei. It was very kind of you. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening to us. Visit our website at parstoday.com/EN. You can download for free our previous episodes on this program too. Also visit our YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
The same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. Guides me through my darkest nights, shows me right from wrong, and a world that often lies. Cause
I don't need anyone,
anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No,
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Years, 30 days. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. A monotheist person not only reflects on the Quran, but also tries to explain the ayahs of this heavenly scripture to others and make them familiar with its teachings. Explicating of the Quranic teachings, first of all, was the duty of the Prophet and his infallible successors. Every faithful too, according to the extent that they had learned from the Ahlul Bayt, embarked on this heavy duty. So, the ulama that are Muslim scholars, took over this duty after the occultation of the 12th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, and have seriously continued this job till the present day. Today, this duty has become highly important due to the broad assault of enemies against the beliefs of Islam and humanity. Dear listeners, in this episode of this Ramadan series, we are going to focus on Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran. This ayah is about insight and deep realization of religion and requirements of time and age. Stay tuned, please. The days of the blessed month of Ramadan are the best opportunity to contemplate on ourselves and the philosophy and meaning of life with regards to the circumstances of modern world. Definitely, improvement and perfection in every human aspect requires full awareness and information on the path to move in. God says in Ayah 104 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran, "Certainly insights have come to you from your Lord, so whoever sees, it is to the benefit of his own soul, and whoever remains blind, it is to its detriment." Some of the great lexicographers of Arabic language believe that the word basirat, insight, is the belief of heart in a religious issue or a reality. Some others have described it as a smartness and admonition. The commander of the faithful, Imam Ali, peace upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha, "Indeed an insightful person is he who hears and thinks, looks and attains foresight, then is admonished, so moves in the clear path and avoids falling in precipice." If one is insightful, he will be able to see near and far environs, just as we should be careful not to fall in precipices and traps in spiritual and social affairs too. We have to take care not to be deceived or go astray. Once a man called Ishaq ibn Ammar came to the 16th infallible successor of the Prophet, Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, and told him, "I have a neighbor who performs prayer a lot, helps the needy, and goes on Hajj pilgrimage very much. I have not seen any wrong from him. What kind of person is he in your opinion?" Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, asked him How is his insight? The man answered, He's not that aware and has no insight in religion. The Imam answered instantly, So he will not gain high rank with these worships either. An insightful person can recognize various currents and encounter them vigilantly. He can discern the plots of enemies and choose his duty towards them. God says in the Quran that faith is the most important factor to attain insight. Insight is the means to differentiate between good and evil, between right and wrong. God-wariness strengthens insight and helps the person to act smartly and wakefully. He will thwart the plots of enemies. The father of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, had an exemplary insight due to his God-wariness. When he was on exile in Neufchâteau Chateau, in the outskirts of Paris, he would not accept private meetings with various personalities, saying, "We have no private place." He used to hold meetings with several persons to witness the whole meeting so that no word would be decreased or increased to the talks. This is what today is happening through compound war and media war. This is called media literacy and considered as a part of insight. Therefore, insight is like having eye in confrontation of various events. Masoud Rajavi, head of the MKO terrorist grouplet, asked for a meeting with Ayatollah Beheshti, who was the judiciary chief in early 1980s. Ayatollah Beheshti accepted his request. Rajavi announced in a meeting that the MKO members were ready to pay allegiance with Ayatollah Beheshti, provided that he accepts their conditions. Martyr Beheshti told him, Our difference with you is not a superficial difference. It is rather a deep difference originated in basic beliefs. My argument for you is that you don't even know Marxism. Then he read out part of Karl Marx's book, Capital, German, and translated it. He said to Rajavi, If you refer to the original German book, you will notice that there are many fundamental mistakes in definition of Marx's economy. You have mixed principles under with the name of Islamic economy and Marxist economy and have found your ideology on this basis. This, while you should have recognized, acted, promoted, and explicated Islam according to its own principles. This very erroneous perception of Islam caused MKO terrorists to murder over 17,000 innocent people in terrorist operations, most of whom were ordinary men, women, and children. One of the most indelible stains in the MKO record was the terrorist blast in which Ayatollah Beheshti and over 70 of the companions of Imam Khomeini were martyred. The more one reflects on the ayahs of the Quran and the statements of the Prophet and his infallible progeny, the more he or she will gain insight and the power to analyze events and conditions. We are duty-bound to think deeply on various events and affairs. This will help us to come to a clear conclusion instead of being trapped in hollow and poor analysis. Weak analysis has been the pitfall of many societies and personalities throughout history. Zulkela was among the companions of Imam Ali, peace upon him, but owing to lack of insight, he was deviated and joined Muawiyah's camp and then became one of his commanders. Although he was fighting in front of falsehood, he thought that he was struggling for God and defending truth. Seeing the Prophet's loyal companion, Ammar Yasir, Zulkela remembered the words of the Prophet when he said, Ammar will be killed by a rebellious lot. this was going to shake him, and that of the many of the deceived forces in Muawiyah's camp, as they could see Ammar on the other side. When Muawiyah noticed this hesitation among his camp, he immediately answered Zulkila, "Who knows whether Ammar will stay with Ali and not join us?" Lack of insight and deep ignorance caused Zulkila to be convinced and stay with the rebel, Muawiyah. He was killed. Ammar was martyred after him to clarify the truthfulness of the Prophet and rightfulness of Imam Ali and his companions. Muawiyah was happy as Zulkila was killed before Ammar because he knew well that had he seen Ammar's martyrdom, half of the Muawiyah's troops would have joined Imam Ali. This is ignorance and stupidity which extinguishes the light of insight.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran strongly condemns Israel's attack on its diplomatic premises in Syria, saying the regime seeks to escalate conflict in the region while evading accountability.